And let's bring Karen Armstrong into this conversation. The renowned religious scholar, author of many books, including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. She is also a former nun who is now a Muslim and creator of a
Muslim.
Are you not?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had read that. Forgive me, Karen. Forgive me. And creator of a document and a movement she calls the Charter for Compassion. You are that, right?
Yes, indeed.
And it's always enlightening to talk to you. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure.
And we've just been taking calls, maybe you've heard the last few, on how people picture God and what happens when they pray. When you think of God, do you have an image of any kind in your head?
No, I don't. I take quite care not to have an image of God in my mind. Because I think God goes beyond any kind of imagery or any kind of thought that we have or any kind of words that we use, really. And there's always it's always important to keep that sense of distinction between what I think about of God and the indescribable reality itself, because it otherwise it's quite easy to make up a God in your own image and likeness.
So if God is that beyond anything, what does God mean to you? Is God the judge and the boss? Is God just love? Is God morally neutral? What is this God you keep putting in the title of your books?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that God, as we understand it, and this has been the in all three of the monotheistic religions which center on the idea of God, there's always been this very strong tradition reminding us that what we think about God has no bearing on the absolute reality itself. Most theology has been about this until the modern period when we started being a bit more confident that we could say exactly what God is. And that's made God incredible. God is transcendence. There is in human life always. There's always been this sense that there's something that always eludes us about the world. A sense of wonder and awe and majesty that and that we see it in the world about us and in other people too. It's important not to tie God down too much to a particular image. I don't pray myself. I've never been any good at it, even in my days as a nun. And I find my prayer, as it were, my main spiritual discipline is my study. I'm sitting right here at my desk right now, and I've put my books aside to talk to you. But sometimes when I'm absolutely involved in studying a sacred text very, very hard, I'll get moments of awe and wonder and delight, just mini seconds of that. Now, my Jewish colleagues tell me that's a very Jewish way of praying.
I was just going to say, that sounds like a very Jewish thing, getting it from the book, the word.
Indeed. But also it's quite Christian. I think your last caller was talking about the religious life in the Catholic Church. Well, Benedictine monks used to spend some part of the day in what they call a divine study, where they immerse themselves in a text and get what they call mini seconds of oratio or prayer when your mind is suddenly lifted in wonder.
In your book, A History of God, you describe why different cultures experienced or, dare I say, created God or a sense of the divine in the way they did at different times and places. Do you think, for the most part, that God is culturally constructed?
Well, that's a very modern question, because before the modern period in the West, religion wasn't a separate activity. As we think of it now as something that's very spiritual, all about God and praying and your inner world, that has really, that it's cut off or separate from other activities of life. But in every culture in the pre-modern world, and that includes the Christian Europe, religion permeated all activities indeed. So that politics, for example, was always seen as a sort of sacred activity. And all state ideologies were religious until the modern period. And so no other culture has this idea of religion as something sealed off mm-hmm. and separated. So trying to take religion out of culture, as it were, is a bit like trying to take the gin out of a cocktail.
So how do you see that, for example, if I may take a maybe controversial example, in the rise of conservative religion today, the Christian right in the U.S., the ultra-Orthodox among the Jews, and the radical Islamists? Do you see any common roots in today's global realities causing those?
Yes, I do. And part of this has been these radical movements you point out, as I explained in my book about the battle for God, have all arisen from a bruising conflict with secularism. All of them have been in some way damaged, if you like, or they feel attacked by a secularism that has been experienced or perceived as intrusive, invasive, and sometimes violent. In the Middle East, for example, secularist regimes such as those of Ataturk or the Shahs of Iran were extremely aggressive. On one occasion in 1935, for example, Shah Reza Pahlavi gave his soldiers orders to shoot at hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in one of the holiest shrines of Iran who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western clothes. And hundreds of Iranians were killed that day. Now, in a context like this, where people have seen their clergy deprived of all their revenues or shot down and tortured or assassinated, secularism doesn't seem benign. And so in many parts of the world where a secular society on the Western model has established itself, a religious countercultural movement has grown up alongside it, feeling bruised and wounded and determined to push God and religion back to center stage. And history shows that whenever these movements are attacked, they almost invariably become more extreme, because that confirms them in their suspicion that religion really is out to destroy them, to destroy their faith. Even in the United States, for example, many Christians in small-town America felt, especially at the beginning of the 20th century, a very sort of violent time with its world wars, that they were being colonized by the secular ethos of Harvard or Yale or Washington, and developed this sort of more, as they said, fundamentalist forms of Christianity.
Karen Armstrong, scholar of religion, author of books including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. And listeners, how do you think your concept of God reflects the circumstances of your life or the culture you live in today? Or how does your experience or practice of religion or perception reflect the circumstances of your life or the culture you live in today if you are a religious person? 212-433-WNYC, or spiritual, however you define it. And let's share some stories, thoughts, and feelings in relation to what Karen Armstrong is saying. For this section of our family meeting on the Brian Lehrer Show on Passover and Easter, roughly defined, I would like to especially invite immigrants to call in. Immigrants from anywhere, how do you see your religion as a reflection of the condition of your life or the culture we live in? And how do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? That's the essential question. Immigrants from everywhere and immigrants from anywhere on this section of the show, the call-in is for you right now. How do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Did God get pictured differently in your country of origin? Did people pray differently in your country of origin and here? Do these differences in prayer and how people experience God or picture God reflect the different lives that people lead there and here? Will any immigrants do a little history of God crowdsourcing for us on this? How do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? 212-433 WNYC, 212-433-9692. So Karen Armstrong, while those calls are coming in, you talked about getting your sense of spiritual joy, if that's the right term, from your study. Is there an emotion that you most feel in connection with your spiritual life? Could you identify one?
Yes, there is, as you say, this sense of wonder and awe and delight. But also, I have to say, a sense of profound disquiet. Because most of the world religions begin with a perception that there's something very wrong with the world, that people are hungry, that people are suffering, that there's injustice in the world, there's an imbalance of power and wealth, people are lonely, sick, dying. The first noble truth of Buddhism is a religion, life is dukkha, it's suffering, awry, there's always something wrong. And in the Christian world, in the Western Christian world, you have an image of a man in an extremity of agony, an agony inflicted upon him by other human beings. And so I think this sense of disquiet, a sense that there's something wrong. The Prophet Muhammad said, not one of you can be a believer if he can sleep when he knows that somebody is hungry. Mm. And now we have this global vision of the world, and we see the suffering that's going on not only in our own society, but also worldwide. That was the impulse really behind my Charter for Compassion, that religions should rally to this call to try to assuage the suffering that we see around us. And in that... In that sort of reaching out to others, and we can't confine it. We're not allowed to confine it to our own group of people or our own cronies. We have to have, as one Chinese sage put it, Yan Ai, concern for everybody. Love the stranger, says Leviticus. Love your enemies, says Jesus. Reach out to all tribes and nations, says the Quran. And from that sense of outreach, there can come a sense of joy and a sense of freedom, really, as you leave your selfish, self-preoccupied state behind.
Joy and freedom from moral outrage and moral sleeplessness, according to Karen Armstrong, with who we will continue in a minute, in addition to your calls on this Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God. Stay with us. It's a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God this morning. Our current guest, the religious scholar Karen Armstrong, author of books including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. And let's take some calls from some of the immigrants among you to talk about whether you think God has a different meaning, religion has a different meaning, whether people pray differently or picture God differently in the country that you came from or the culture that you came from or the conditions that you came from compared to here. Let's try Gloria in Westchester to start this off. Hi, Gloria. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Adore your show.
Thank you.
Yes, I was raised in a country that was 95% Catholic. I am now a recovering Catholic. When the church told me that I couldn't use birth control, and when I stopped using birth control to go back for the absolution, so I never went back.
What country are you from originally?
Colombia.
And do you think that people in Colombia experience their Catholicism differently from the people you know here, even though you personally are lapsed?
Colombia is still very much a Catholic country, but as I came to the United States and began to study and read things that were not allowed for me to read in Colombia, even at the university, I realized that all the sacred texts were man-written, And therefore, God became a man, and all they do is impose more rules and hardship.
And the same here as there, basically.
Yes,
because my question is to ask you to compare the experience of Catholicism that you think people have in Colombia or people you knew in Colombia compared to what you see in the United States. Anything on that?
Well, the United States is much more ecumenical because the separation of church and state. Colombia didn't have a separation of church and state until 1992. So everybody was Catholic, and the bishops ran the country as they wanted to. And so definitely it's a very different way of seeing the Catholic Church here or in Colombia.
Gloria, thank you so much.
Let's
try Yaya in the Bronx. Do I have your name right? Is it Yaya?
Yes, sir. You have my name right.
Thank you for calling. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Yemen in the Middle East.
So what would you like to compare?
I would like to compare the way my interaction with the society feels in Yemen and in the United States. So in Yemen, it's very much the same religion as Islam, and you don't experience any kind of diversity in religions. But when I came to the United States, there's different religions, there's different sects of religions, there's different churches, there's different mosques, Sunni and Shiite, and there's, you know, diversity. And the beautiful thing about this country is that de facto, the government is supporting diversity, and no one can impose anything upon you.
Did it give you a different relationship with your, I'm assuming you're Muslim, once you came here, that you still identify, but your relationship to it changed?
Actually, my experience with Islam has increased when I came to the United States. The Muslim population in the United States is actually more religious than the populations in the Middle East. In the mosque, people are more dedicated to the mosque. People come and spare donations. People come, and Ramadan feels different in the United States than it feels in the Middle East.
Really? More devoted? Do you think that's a matter of the choice that people have here as opposed to the obligation and only one way to do things that you were describing home in Yemen?
Yeah, I think people in the United States, because they miss where they're from, and they live in a different society, they want to feel more connected with where they're from and their faith. And I find it surprising at first when I saw that people in here, my colleagues and my friends, are actually more practicing Muslims than the ones in Yemen. Like, we actually have, like, Friday seminars and Saturday seminars that I've benefited from more than I have learned in Yemen. So.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Karen Armstrong, that's an intriguing call, a counterintuitive call maybe, that Muslims here would be more observant than the ones in Yemen where he came from. And I think it relates to what you were describing earlier about how until the modern era, when we would look at things from the outside and ask ourselves if religion is culturally constructed, that it's so interwoven with the society, the more traditional society that he came from, that it takes on a different meaning. What were you thinking as you heard that call?
Well, it is quite common for immigrants to be more observant in their new country than they were at home. And also it gives people a sense of community, of familiarity, too, a sort of link with home, if you like. It's certainly also, I think, the case here in the UK. In the UK, we are a very secular country indeed. Only 6% of the population attend a religious service regularly here.
So much more secular than the United States.
Far, far more secular. It's always intriguing to me that when I come to the United States, I can talk to people very differently about religion than from here. I mean, I have friends who are sort of rather appalled that I managed to make a living out of writing about this discredited stuff about religion. But I think that a large proportion of that 6% of people who are observant in this country are Muslim. I think they've bumped up our national average considerably. So I think that is quite. It's not called counterintuitive. It's quite a common phenomenon.
Nicholas in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello, Brian. Thank you. I'm actually originally from Palestine, but I'm raised Greek Orthodox.
Uh-huh.
And I've been in this country quite a few years. You can feel the division where I was raised as a Greek Orthodox, and then I became a Baptist since I went to the school there, between the religions, between a Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, because it was under the Israeli government as well. Whereas when you come to this country, and you don't feel that division between religions as much as you would feel when you are back home. And it's quite, unfortunately, it's not right for the people to be feeling this way, because they all, as people, should be more equal. But the mentality and the way they are raised, and then the Baptist community that I belong to, later on when I came to America, I found out that it's more about money and really for the priest or the pastor that does preaching, that he actually collects the money to have a better financial situation for him and maybe have a Learjet that he spreads the word of God, whereas the rest of the people here really are not in that situation, but they give the money to them because they are followers.
So does this make you cynical about religion here, about even your religion here?
It does, because really I believe in myself. I believe that there is a God. You know, I don't know what form. It's a force that exists. I don't think it's a human, because it's a force. But I disregard the sections of religion, because it creates problems among people. And it creates problems as well in the world. And here we have, unfortunately, the racism problem, but religion is the base of the problems that we have in this world.
Nicholas, thank you very much. Marie in Queens, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Miss Armstrong. Just to answer your question just briefly, I'm from the Caribbean, I'm from Haiti, and how we worship there differently, I want to say it's about the wealth of the country and our resources are limited. We're open to God in everything that we do. We bare our souls when we worship, so it's not superficial. Even in this country where you go to Haitian congregations, they pray much differently than we do, as English speakers. We
like
bare
how?
Our souls, we give everything.
Is it more ecstatic?
Loud.
Is it more loud?
No. I'm from a very conservative congregation with Seventh-day Adventist Sabbatarians.
Uh-huh.
We're less proud of, physical accomplishment and worldly things. We really focus on God and our relationship with Him. All the external and superficial college degrees, money, that is all set aside when we worship where I'm from. I don't know if it has to do with the situation of the country. Here in this country, I find that we're a little proud when we approach God.
Proud?
Yeah.
Too proud of us as individuals and
Correct.
Our egos?
Yes, too proud. Like, for example, I'm Brian Lehrer. I have a great show. You know, when I approach God, I'm not as a sinner. I don't approach Him as a sinner and that He creates me. He gives me this job. He gave me health this morning. So where I'm from, we go to the minute. We go to the very small detail of who God is to us as our creator, as the giver of life, pardoning our sins.
Yes.
You know, He will resurrect us again. We go to the detail, and it's an everyday thing. I find with English speakers in this country, we're a little, proud. I think that's the best word I can say.
Yeah, Marie, thank you. Thank you so much. So well put. Karen Armstrong, maybe a great example of religion being culturally constructed or the individual's relationship to it.
Yes, I think there's certainly a lot to be said for our very capitalist-driven societies where where the whole emphasis is often on efficiency, progress, wealth. And also, we are very sort of puffed up about ourselves in the Western world, I think, generally. And it's ego. It's ego, selfishness, greed that your previous caller was saying about people just embezzling or sort of taking money from the congregations. It's that holds us back from the divine and from our best selves and from enlightenment. And the whole point about religion is to lose the self, to put the self to one side, and the best way of doing that is by concentrating on the other in compassion,
and
putting another person in the center of your world.
In the context of our culture, so much of that, I think, would be about losing the privilege. I was in D.C. over the weekend, and I saw the Martin Luther King Memorial for the first time. And one of the things that struck me about the quotes that were engraved there was his universalism. He was a Christian preacher, but he would say things about how we need to go beyond our own race, religion, tribe, and our connection to the world. I think the Easter and Passover stories can both connect us to the world or just connect us to our religious or cultural tribes. But what King was talking about from an American perspective, especially in the late 60s, the latter part of his life, when he got into anti-Vietnam War protesting, was, I think, to see the rest of the world through our lens of privilege as Americans, even Black Americans.
Yes, and it's a coincidence, Brian, because 2 weeks ago I was in Atlanta at Morehouse College, which is Martin Luther King's college.
Yes.
And we were I was there for the anniversary of his death. And you're quite right about King. And I think that his experience, you see, of suffering, of marginalization, gave him, instead of using that experience of pain to inflict pain on other people, it gave him an insight into the pain and marginalization of people all over the world. And I think that is a huge example of what religion can do. It's to open our hearts to the suffering of others and work hard, as he did, for a better world with that sense of disquiet that I was talking about earlier. And, of course, it reminds us that religion isn't all about having a nice, warm experience. It can be dangerous and risky. I mean, he, like Gandhi, lost his life. Was killed, there's that religion is something that puts us on the edge, not to make us too comfortable in this world.
So in our last minute, do you see these holidays of Easter and Passover as making your compact for compassion either easier or harder to achieve?
Compassion is always something that's hard to achieve. But it's also something that human beings recognize in the core of their being as something that is not just a nice idea, but absolutely essential, I think, for the survival of our species, that we learn to treat all others, whoever they are, as we wish to be treated ourselves. If we don't do this, we're not going to have a viable world. Now, interestingly, some of the people who've come forward to help me most with the charter have not been religious people, but secular people. But I think we can all see at the heart of these religious celebrations the ideals of the religious life, the ideal of freedom, of liberation, of turning our backs, as it were, upon oppression, which is the story of the Passover. And Abelard, the great French philosopher, said that when we look at the agony of Jesus on the cross, our hearts break within us, and it is that act of compassion that saves us rather than just his sacrificial death.
Karen Armstrong, author of best-selling books on religion and founder of the Charter for Compassion, which you can see at charterforcompassion.org. Thank you so much. Happy Easter, happy Passover, happy life.
Happy Easter, happy Passover, and all the good wishes to you too, Brian.